Grace, the Amy Santiago of Royal Bloggers.
And I'm Jessica, the Dorothy Sporanath of Royal Bloggers.
And we'd like to welcome you to On Air, the podcast where two cynical Brits discuss the latest royal news and the truth behind the stories. Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the On Air podcast. We are not talking about any health crises or even about Britain, which is a miracle. So we are actually talking about Denmark because earlier last week, the Danish royal family released their annual report and we thought, great, that gives us something to talk about. So we're going to go through it.
What I'm about to say, everybody remember that I'm British. So saying nice things about myself makes me feel physically in pain. But I think I am probably one of the more knowledgeable people in the world about British royal finances.
I'd agree with that.
Thank you. I'm glad you're delusional.
Yeah, no, you know nothing about finances. What are you on about?
All of the other royal families, I think my knowledge of them was sort of my knowledge of most things, which is I'm a generalist, so I know a little bit about a lot. So that if I'm at a social occasion, people will think I'm cultured and intelligent and interesting because I know little anecdotes. But then they meet me a second time and they realise, oh no, she doesn't know anything about Russian literature.
Yeah, she knew one anecdote.
Even though I was sort of like, oh well, you know, I wish something dramatic had happened that we could talk about. Actually, I did learn a lot through doing this episode.
It showed me how little I pay attention to the other royal family. Because I was reading through going, to not know any of this had happened. The first half of the report is all about the kind of work the Danish royals did in 2023. And there was a little introduction where they were like, so we wrote this before everyone changed jobs. So when we say the Queen, we mean Margrethe. And when we say the Crown Prince, we mean Frederick. And then the first thing that sort of excited me, that I remotely found interesting, was I think on sort of the first page where they talk about like the general year of the royal family in Denmark. And they said that in 2023, they've been back to work. There's not really been COVID. Everyone's been out and about. And they'd done 430 official engagements and official events and arrangements in Denmark and foreign countries. And I was like, well, that seems like a very small number.
Well, do you know, Grace, that was the first thing that I noted down as an observation.
So good at this.
Well, actually, technically, what I noted down, when you said the first half of the document is about, actually, the first 43 pages, I don't think it needed to be 43 pages long. But no, other than that, the actual first real observation that was of any value was the 430 engagements thing. So 2023, the British royals did 2,270 engagements. I know we said we weren't going to do the British royal family, but we have immediately launched into comparing the Danes to the British royal family. But I think that's because most of our listeners will know the British royal family. And actually, to be fair, they're the only royal family that has this random person who counts up all of the engagements and have this court circular that's like a separate diary of everything that they do that isn't just on their website. So, you know, yeah, obviously 430 engagements versus 2,270 engagements is quite a discrepancy. But I think Denmark is about 10% of the size of the UK population. So on one hand, 430 might sound like a small number, but if you think about it per person, which you don't have to, no, but you know, there's no reason you have to think about it that way. But if you did want to compare them on that metric, then they're actually doing a lot better.
Yeah, much higher percentage.
Yeah. So yeah, this is only one mechanism to compare them, but I think it shows that like, if you just compare the raw numbers, it might seem like, wow, how is this family doing so much more and this family's doing so much less? But actually, their populations are drastically different, and this is the trouble with comparing.
Yeah, I went to look at their 2022 report, and in 2022, they did 500-ish. So I was like, okay, so it's a dip from 500, even though they said this is the first year they've been back to it and back in. So I thought that was interesting. But then I tried to look at the years before that. And then obviously the last 2 years before that were COVID. So they just didn't tell us. But yeah, I think even sort of as I kind of moved through it and looked at the things where they did give us numbers for like the amount of times it happened, like they said the amount of people who had, you know, ambassadors they met with and things like that. And it was all slightly down, or slightly up in 2023, actually, not down. So clearly there is a bit of a sort of increase across the board in the things they gave us numbers in. So it does seem like the high numbers in 2022 were probably Jubilee inflation.
You know, you've also got the size of the family. There's Margrethe, Mary and Frederick doing the bulk of the work. And then you've got Benedict, who's Margrethe's sister, who does a little bit. That's an average of 107 engagements per person in Denmark. Whereas in the UK last year, there's 11 working royals. So they're the average per person. And obviously, I know that a lot of them don't do full working, full engagements, but theoretically they could. So I'm counting them as a person. And so it's an average per person of 206. So actually, even though it looks like, well, the British Royals should be doing 4,300 engagements in order to be at the same rate per person as the Danes, actually, on an individual level, people are doing more.
Yeah, I think also when you look at it, Denmark is Denmark and the Faroe Islands and Greenland. And then the UK is, obviously it's the UK, but then they've also got the Commonwealth realms. So it's 15 countries. Which is significantly higher.
150 million, I think it is, the population or something like that.
So you would always expect Britain to do more. And also, I think, you know, culturally, I'd say that Denmark is more sort of laid back. Like, sometimes they cycle to engagements. You couldn't imagine, you know, Charles rocking up on a bike to an engagement and he's the big environment man. So,
but I think it's interesting, though, because the Brits are doing more per person and they're doing more overall, but actually per person of like the population, they're doing significantly less. So it totally compares on like how you want, it totally differs depending on how you want to compare them. So I don't know, like when I was doing this section, I was sort of like, are they doing a lot less or are they doing a lot more? I don't know.
Because I think I ended up with being like, it feels to me like the Danes are doing more, because they're doing more per person, particularly if you factor in the Commonwealth, except in terms of like from a royal watching point of view, they're doing a lot less because I'm seeing them less. So it just depends whether I'm thinking about me personally and being selfish or if I'm thinking about the people of Denmark.
Yeah. And is it possible that there is just a cap? Like one person can only do so much, you know, you'd have to have all 11 people in the royal family working as much as Anne in the UK. And like, I just don't think that that's sustainable or desirable even. I don't think people want loads more royals added on, that you would, if you wanted to have like the per capita rate in the UK being the same as in Denmark, you'd have to have extra people. If people aren't going to up their individual counts, you'd have to have more people. So, and I don't think that's desirable either. So is it possible that it's just like, there is just a cap and they can't do any more? I do think they can do more than 2,200 or however much it was. but, you know, is it possible that it's easier to do more in a small country, or, you know, is it just a quirk of how the statistics work out because it is a smaller country that even if they do hardly anything, it will always seem bigger?
Yeah, that's a good point. And also in Denmark, they've got, particularly Margrethe, Fred and Mary, have got such high approval ratings. There's not like a worry of oversaturation. Whereas I think for people, particularly people like Camilla, who hasn't got high approval ratings, you know, even like the Duke of Kent, who no one really knows who he is. If suddenly, you know, the Duke of Kent was out every single day doing four engagements a day and he was on, you know, the news for all of them, people would be going, who is this man? And why are we spending all our taxpayer funded media covering this man? So I think, you know, there's more of a PR angle of it as well.
That probably also contributes to sort of how it feels sometimes as a kind of royal watcher, because I watch most royal families quite equally. You know, I think if you're a British royal family fan first and foremost, then you're going to see the Brits more because that's what you follow. Whereas I follow most royal families to a fairly equal degree. And I feel like I see the Danes a lot more. But I think that's possibly because it's a core group of like three people who get a lot of attention. Whereas in Britain, there is like Camilla and the King, and I mean it's really William and Kate, and then so I don't really see what the Duke of Gloucester or the Duke of Kent or the Duchess of Gloucester are doing. They are pulling in the numbers, we know. I think the last year the Duke of Gloucester did like 100 engagements on his own, you know, it's not small numbers, but it feels like that doesn't really contribute to the overall sense of how often I personally feel like I see them.
Yeah.
So I think it's an interesting thing because depending on how you want to look at it, you can say that the Danes are doing incredibly well, or you can say that they're not. So you could say that they're not doing as well because they did less than they did in 2022, even though that was a Jubilee year. Or you could say they're doing really well because they're doing more per populate per person within Denmark. Or you could say that they're doing really badly because they're doing half the number per person within the royal family as the Brits. So it's, there's lots of conversations about like, oh, this person's so lazy and this person doesn't do any work. And this, there's a lot of fighting between like British royal fans and sort of Scandinavian royal fans. It just shows that like whatever metric you use, you can make fit your criteria. And really, it's hard to compare two drastically different situations.
Yeah, so that whole thing was kind of useless. But
No, we had to go through it in order to discount it. That's the scientific method. You can't just assume that it's not a useful comparison. You have to go through and show why it's not useful, Grace.
fair enough. I will agree with that. So the next thing I had was less dramatic than the entire number counts for the year, but was the fact that I learned that in Denmark, citizens can seek an audience with the monarch. Didn't know that
Oh.
was a thing. It feels like the kind of thing that would happen in medieval times, where
Mm.
like every second Thursday, the peasants could go to the king and be like, "Please, sir, can we have some more corn for our village?" But
That's happened all the
that.
time in the medieval era. Like, can we have, do they even have corn? Where does corn
Don't know.
grow?
I feel like corn is more
Is that
hot,
American?
needs to be heater. Yeah, American, Kansas.
We don't actually grow corn in this country. This is not our area of expertise, quite clearly.
But yeah, this is what interested me because I didn't know this was a thing. But it feels like the type of thing that in, fantasy novels, it's the thing that the evil king does in a fantasy novel to make himself seem like a good king. Not that I'm saying that Margaret was an evil queen doing this to look like a good queen. But I really like the concept of
Does it say what they talk about?
it. It says they could, citizens could seek an audience with the monarch, and it happens twice a month, and they could be from business or politics or charities. So I assume they just go and have, a bit of a chat,
Oh, I
which I
like that.
don't really know. I looked in 2022 and it said 1,100 people had met with the Queen.
Wow.
And then last year it was 1,500 people had met with the Queen and Crown Prince Frederick.
That's
So.
quite a lot. That's really interesting because we did our episode Beauty Based Zero, if people want to go and Beauty Based Zero, if people want to go and listen to that, which is where we, Grace and I, sort of play dictator and decide what we would do to change the monarchy. But one of the things we suggested was having like a council of advisors, random people who are, pillars of the community in their society or who have done a lot of charity work or who are, just a cross section of society. And I feel like this is possibly a way to do that. I think a lot of times when royals meet people, through like a patronage or something, it's like you've got the whole press there, you're there because it's part of your job. So I think it's quite a nice way to kind of somebody can go and talk about something that matters to them in a private setting, speak openly to the monarch.
Yeah, I had a look at the a report, and it was like they gave an example from one of the meetings, and it was like a mayor and an electrician and a nurse, which just seemed like I wonder how you get picked for this. Like, do you have to apply? Is there a ballot? Do they go around to knock on your house, say, "It's your turn if you'd like to go meet the monarch"? It's your turn. Come on, it's like jury duty, but
Yeah.
you got to go and talk to the monarch.
No, I think that's I hadn't picked up on that because I t to be fair it was 43 pages and I skim read most of it. So that's really interesting actually.
The next thing I've got is the sort of the last thing before they went person by person was they talked about kind of all the other royal families and country leaders, heads of state, that's the word, country leaders that they'd met over the year. They said they'd done Norway and Spain, they'd done Sweden, and then the Czechia, Korea, and the Ukraine came to Denmark as well. In my head, I was like, every country must just have two incoming and two outgoing visits from other countries every year. So obviously Norway and Spain were incoming state visits. Czechia, Korea, and Ukraine were just casual visits from the leaders of those countries. And the visit to Sweden was for Carl Gustaf's Jubilee. But it did seem like a significantly because it wasn't counting any visits they'd done to other countries at this point. This was just the people coming to see them, which was, in my head, quite a significant number. I'm trying to figure out how many people like pop into again to Britain to visit, you know, Charles, that isn't an official sort of state visit or, you know, for like the coronation or something, because this wasn't for a jubilee or, you know, a big birthday. This wasn't for Christian's birthday. This was just generally apart from that, and it seemed like a bigger number than normal. So whether everyone's just really excited that we're in a post-COVID world and they all went a bit mad and visited people loads last year, I don't know.
Well, it reminds me a little bit of Kate going to Denmark. When she did that trip to learn about the earlier sector in Denmark, she went over there and she had an official audience with Margrethe and Mary. And I feel like if Mary was going to the UK to visit the earlier sector or the women's sector, because she's very involved in women's shelters and things like that, I don't know if she would always be given the same courtesy and response. Where I like, she might meet with somebody who's like Sophie, who does a lot of work with women, who's a bit lower down, or she might meet with the Minister for Women rather than a member of the royal family. And so I wonder if that's like a, it's also part of it is like the difference because there's sort of three of them, whether they all just sort of always extend that courtesy if you like you get to meet somebody who's really important. Whereas in the UK they've got like 11 people, so they're like, oh well, you could meet the Duke of Kent. That's he's getting a real hammering in this episode of it.
Yeah, sorry, Duke again.
Sorry, you seem like a nice guy, but yeah, you know, you could meet the Duke of Kent for this particular, you know, rather than getting an audience with the monarch. I wonder if that's part of maybe why it feels like they see so many people.
I'm slightly breaking with my going through this in order thing, but they spoke about the sort of abroad trips they did as well. And Mary and Frederick, between them, had 20 trips abroad.
Yeah. Whew.
And I was like, and they seemed to treat the they had a tour of India in the February, I think, which was like their big annual tour, you know, like overall, like to have a big one. And then they had all these sort of other ones, and they went to, you know, to Fiji and to Niger and to London and to the New York and Australia and Italy and all of these places. And not to immediately compare it to Britain, like we've been doing this entire episode, but all I could think was if Kate had done 20 abroad trips in 1 year, I would be so happy. I would literally never shut up about it.
Well, I mean, to compare it to a different royal family, to just, you know, so that nobody can say that we're only comparing to the Brits. I mean, my primary family that I follow is the Swedish royal family and primarily Crown Princess Victoria. And I would say that they probably go on like 12. So that's even, you know, that's significantly less than Mary and Frederick.
Yeah, because I thought when I read it, I was like, is this a normal thing for royal family to do? And are Britain just being snobby and be like, we're not going to visit people, they can visit us. But yeah, to hear it's so much more than you know, Sweden. And what sort of really struck me was how many of them were individual visits abroad. You know, like when Fred went to sort of Niger or when Mary went to Australia, they were individual sort of visits rather than duo ones. So, you know, it wasn't 20 paired, it was 20 altogether. But I mean, even I think normal people would be a bit normal people, non-royal people would be a bit stretched to, you know, go for like, yeah, can you have 9 solo trips abroad from your partner this year? Which would be like, okay, that's kind of pushing it now. I will do 3 at the most.
Yeah, well, I think that's another thing. Like I don't have the statistics, so I could be absolutely wrong about this, but I feel like in most royal families the heir does loads and then their consort does like maybe half the level that they do. And I think that's probably fair in Sweden of like Daniel does do overseas trips alone, but not as many, and it's usually like to Switzerland for the World Economic Forum. Whereas I feel like in Denmark, and as I say, this might not be backed up by the statistics, but I feel like Mary does a lot. And that's not a bad thing, but it's just like that might also be impacting it. Of like most royal families, you've got sort of, it's sort of like one and a half persons or people who are doing the numbers because it's the main person and then their spouse does like half. Whereas I feel like in Denmark, it's two people who are doing
Yeah,
overseas visits, you know.
I'd agree. Yeah, I think Mary definitely. She, I think it's why I think so many people forget Mary as a consort and not a royal. And it's not just because of sort of, you know, how she carries herself or the fact she's really good in a tiara, but she does in my head, she does more work than Frederick. And I'm sure, you know, if I broke it down, they're fairly even. But that in itself is sort of unusual. So then they broke it down into person by person. They started with the Queen, as is wont to do, and they essentially spent the entire time being like, so she had surgery and had to postpone everything. And that was like the entire thing. There was a little bit where they said she went to visit, I think it was Bornholm Island, and invited all of the permanent residents for tea.
Oh, fun.
And I loved that. I was like, I went and Googled the population of Bornholm Island, which is 39,993 people, according
Oh,
to Google.
they can't all fit on the boat.
I know. I'm thinking that must be a big royal yacht to get them all on. But I assume they came in like stages, not all at once. That would be a bit overwhelming. But the big Margherita talking point for me was how much of her creative work was mentioned. In my head, she does her queen work, and as a side career, she
Yeah.
does her creative work, and they are not interlinked. However, more of the Margherita section in this document was devoted to her creative work than her queen work. And I was like, is that allowed? Can you do that? Can you just be like, yeah, and also in her spare time, she does some painting.
I found that very interesting, I'll be honest, because they had a bit about the work that Margherita did on a Netflix film. And so I was really surprised to see that bit in particular. Like, I mean, fair enough, you want to talk about like, oh, the Queen likes painting or whatever. But it sort of brought up some questions for me when I saw that Netflix film bit being included, because I was like, I always thought that was separate work, kind of like how the Queen over here had horses that sometimes might win Royal Ascot. They wouldn't put that in the annual report. So I was kind of like, well, does then this count as official work? And then I started thinking, actually, does she get paid for this? And if so, why is something that's being paid for privately being included in this report? And if she doesn't, does that mean that some of the money that she gets from the state goes towards helping her find the time to do an, you know, it just it I'm sure they wanted it to be like a, oh, look at the fun things that the Queen is interested in. And that's probably how it came across in Denmark. But to me, I was just like, this is weird that they put in a private money-making, potentially, enterprise.
Even with the part about, you know, she does the costumes and the scenography for a lot of ballets, they spoke about Snow Queen, which obviously is a Danish ballet, and then but then they said, like, entirely writing that she also did 8 ballet productions that year. She did the costumes for it, and I was like, okay, so either she does that in just out of her, you know, kindness of her heart for no money, or she's doing it as a royal, which just seems to be a bit above and beyond the role of a royal, if you know, to costume 9 ballet productions,
Yeah.
or she's being paid to do it. And then if she is being paid to do it, why is it only, you know, why are all the ballet productions at this one particular ballet house? And I'm sure in Denmark that's fine, but here, if, you know, any royal was, you know, specifically going out of their way to work for one ballet house or opera house or theatre, I feel like everyone else would be getting a bit annoyed and going off about it in the media.
I think that it's important to be clear as well that, like, because there's been a lot of conversation about this in recent years about sort of, oh, you know, the royals aren't blocked from being able to make any of their own money and isn't it unfair and blah, blah, blah. That's not true. The royals can make their own money. Like, Anne has property that she rents out for various events and things and makes money that way. The Queen had horses. People are allowed to have private jobs. So I don't have a problem with Margherita doing a job for Netflix or designing the costumes and getting paid for that. I don't have a problem with that. It just seems odd to include it in something that is an annual report of their official work. And again, it doesn't seem to have caused any fuss in Denmark. So at the end of the day, it's fine. But at the same time, it just, yeah, it's something that struck me as sort of like, oh, I think this confuses things. It blurs that line between sort of private income and public income.
Yeah, that's what I think was interesting for me. It was the fact it was involved, included, raised loads of questions that I didn't have before. Because before I was like, yeah, of course she does in her spare time make costumes for the ballet. And that's perfectly okay. And I will fight anyone who says it isn't. And then they included it. And I was like, okay, maybe it's not okay. So next in the Royal Report was Fred and Mary. That was really boring. So I just skipped over it.
Same.
And then we got to Joachim and Marie, and I did laugh a bit because they started Joachim's section by saying he had two highlights of the year. His son, Prince Henrique's confirmation, and moving to Washington, D.C. And I was like, no, he quite famously said that was not a highlight for him. He did not want to do that. That was an interesting. They didn't have to write in there that he was super happy about this two joyous occasions of the year.
I was surprised they mentioned them in their own section at all, to be honest. This is like, it didn't need to be 43 pages, but they included absolutely everybody. And I was a little bit surprised when I scrolled down and saw that they had their own section. But they just entirely glossed over all of the, which I suppose that's fair. They didn't include Prince Andrew in the accounts for the British royal family. So, I mean, maybe that's fair.
Yeah, I was surprised when I saw them, and then I was like, "Oh no, that makes sense." But it was just, and I liked how Marie's section was like, "Yeah, she promotes culture. She's doing loads of stuff with neuroscience. She's literally attending brain conferences." And then with Joachim, he was just like, "Yeah, he's in Washington, because we sent him there, and that's all we've got for you." Then it was Benedict, and again, very boring. I
Boring.
mean, I'm sure it was not boring for her, but it was boring for me. And then the last bit before we get into the finances was a bit about the foundations. And there are three foundations: Queen Margrethe and Prince Henrik's. Then it was the Crown Prince Frederick and Crown Princess Mary Foundation, which they have since changed the name of. So that one they were just changing in moments. And then the Nikolai and Felix Foundation. Didn't know that was a thing. Why do they have one and no one else gets one?
I found out that existed in this report, but I did find out the background of it.
Oh, good, because they didn't tell me that in the report. They told me every other background.
Yeah. No, I only found out that that existed in this report as well. I'd literally never heard of it in my entire life before. And I'd heard of well, I don't think I'd heard of Margrethe and Henrik's either, to be honest, but I assumed it existed. It wasn't a surprise. But then yeah, I saw Nikolai and Felix and I was like, okay, there are loads of other grandchildren. Why do they get their own one? But basically, so this is actually quite a common thing that happens in most royal families, or lots of royal families anyway. When there's a big event like a wedding, royals will set up a fund, and people who want to give them a gift, they don't necessarily want to accept that from somebody who they don't know personally. So they say like, you can donate to this fund in lieu of a gift. But they also do things like they'll sell memorabilia, and some of the money from that memorabilia will go towards this fund. So I think in the UK, William and Kate sold their wedding program. And for Margrethe and Henrik and Frederick and Mary's foundations, they were set up initially using money from sales of commemorative wedding coins. And then Nikolai and Felix's one, it actually used to be Prince Joachim and Princess Alexandra's foundation. So Nikolai and Felix are the grandchildren of Queen Margrethe. Joachim and Alexandra are their parents. They were married and then they divorced. And so they set up their foundation with some money that they were given as a gift, I think by the people of Greenland. And somewhere else. But they were given some money. It wasn't through the sales of like coins and things. It was a donation that was given from a country to them. And they set up this fund with it. But then, of course, when they divorced, Alexandra left the royal family, became a countess instead of a princess. And so they renamed it after their two children. And so it became the Nikolai and Felix Foundation. So that is the origin.
That makes somewhat more sense.
Yes,
I
yes.
did think it was just a bit harsh that they only gave it to the eldest children and no one else. But then that does raise the question: did Joachim and Marie not get a foundation?
Seems like
Or
no.
there's a one woman, one wedding thing. But yeah, I looked and it said they gave 9.5 million Danish money, krone. I was like, Danish krone, krona? Yeah, Danish krona to 134 projects. And then that broke down to 102 came from Margrethe's foundation, 15 from Mary and Frederick's foundation, and 17 from Nikolai and Felix's foundation. And then I checked 2022, and they had slightly more money in 2022. They had it said more than 10 million, which is more than 9.5, but unknown of the exact
It could
amount.
be 900 million, couldn't it?
Yeah, they got a load.
Probably like 10.5, but it could be 900 because that is more than 10.
Any amount more than 10 million. And they gave it to slightly fewer projects, so to 123 projects. And 81 of those were from the Margrethe Foundation, 15 again from Mary and Frederick's Foundation, but 27 from the Nikolai and Felix Foundation. So it was fascinating to me whether or not like the Nikolai and Felix Foundation is going to slowly wind down now they're not royals. Considering I didn't know this was a thing, I will be really interested next year to see if the change in monarch means that Mary and Frederick are going to give 102 different projects money, their foundation, or if, you know, Margrethe's fund is still going to be so much bigger because she's had so much longer to sort of accumulate money.
Well, yeah, I think it's very interesting because, as I say, it's not unusual. Like, this is not a specifically Danish thing. So actually, Sophie and Edward over here in the UK, they had a fund set up after their wedding. It was set up. And so the accounts in the UK for charities only go back a certain length of time. You can only find publicly available accounts for like 7 years or something. So we know that they have, since at least 2017, they have barely given out any donations from their trust. And it closed in 2023. So they got married in 1999, so that's 24 years, and it wasn't really operational for about 7 years before that. Whereas Margrethe and Henrik have kept theirs alive for over 50 years. Henrik's dead.
And it's still, yeah, he's still doing it.
It's still going. So I think it's not like a specifically Danish thing to set up a fund when you get married or when you have a big life event. I think the difference is that in Denmark, they seem to actually invest in building it. So Mary and Frederick, they now have like eight founding partners who are mostly companies and charitable trusts who kind of keep it going. So they continue to fund it and they don't do public fundraising or anything. But, it, you know, they're not reliant on just that money that they had in from their wedding. They've kept it going and kept investing. And it's now, you know, a lucrative charity that is able to hand out a lot of money. Whereas the Wessex Trust, I mean, I never even heard them do anything with it before 2017. And then they stopped giving out grants and then it closed down. So they haven't changed their status specifically in 2017. So there's no particular reason why they would be giving less. It's just that they don't seem to be giving through that. They don't seem to see that as the focus of their charitable giving. The difference is obviously in the UK, we have like the Royal Foundation, which is more similar to the Danish model, although it wasn't set up through wedding money. It was set up separately. And I think so we can, that's probably the best comparison you can make. And I think that you can see that it has positives and negatives to it because I think it's really great that they had this section where they were able to say, we gave this much money to this many organizations, because that feels really tangible to people. It also can provide a real focus for their work, but we've also seen that it can consume everything they do. So with the Royal Foundation, I think some of our issues have been that most of what William and Kate do, particularly Kate, I would say, is through the Royal Foundation. And so that cuts off all these other charities and organizations who they can't go and visit because they're going to do a visit for the Royal Foundation instead. I don't think that Denmark has got that balance wrong. I think they do a really good job of, like, Mary does a lot of work for her fund, but also does a lot of work for other things too.
Yeah, I think the way they've kind of taken these foundations and sort of grown them into successes reminded me kind of like the Swedish approach where, like, when Estelle was born, they set up, is it a foundation in her name that sort of Daniel's on the board of?
Oh, that wasn't like, when she was born, but yes, there is a cultural foundation that was set up in her name.
Cultural one. Because obviously by the time she's an adult and ready to sort of take over, it will be functioning. You know, we say a lot that royals work in decades and in centuries and millennia, whereas everyone else works in seconds and minutes. But I think Denmark have done a really good job of taking something and, you know, Margrethe and Henrik's has been for, you know, nearly 50 years running and building and accumulating money and then handing that money out. And it's one of those things that royals are in a sort of unique position to be able to do.
Yeah.
Because they are there for life. They're not, you know, they've not got a 4-year term, or they're not entirely dependent on the public's, you know, whims of the moment. They just kind of are there. Carry on doing the day.
Even though I know it's not their money, there probably is a limit on their legal responsibility for the charities because they're not going to want them to be responsible for them on a legal level. But, I think it still feels like they're really involved. Because at first when I read this, I was like, why is the Royal Foundation stuff in this report? That those organizations all have their own accounts. But actually, it is a good way to kind of make it seem like they're doing something extra beyond just like what you'd the ribbon cutting of royalty. My only other observation was actually just about the general report itself. The way it was written kind of reminded me of like a glossy magazine spread, because there was an unusually high number, and I say this as a British person, this is all we talk about, but there were an unusually high number of references to the weather. So, like, for example, there was a bit that said, to the tunes of the national anthem, the townspeople of Fredensborg welcomed the Queen home to Fredensborg ca Palace with a traditional torchlight procession on a cool evening in April. And there were so many references, like on a warm summer's day, and like it was very, yeah, glossy magazine. And I didn't dislike it. It was quite amusing.
I feel like when I do look at sort of other reports in general, they're like black and white,
Yeah.
boring. Here's the facts, maybe a picture or a graph if you're lucky.
Well, yeah, like the British Royal Family's report starts off with a, which I do appreciate, but it starts off with this massive section about the responsibilities and the role in society that the monarch has. So it's like, it's not fluffy, is it?
No, there's nothing in there about the weather.
No, they never tell you what the weather was like.
And obviously, because we were reading the English language version, I did go and look at the Danish one just to see if it like matched up. Because I was like, obviously, they're changing the language, and sometimes, you know, you can get one word that is translated to like five words in another language. And I was fairly impressed by how well it kept everything to the same sort of page length. It was only the finances section that was longer in Denmark. But I was like, you know, I have to give some credit to the graphic designer behind this because they planned this perfectly.
Yeah. They really did. Yeah, they did a good job. Well, actually, that does lead us on to the finances, because my first bit to sort of warn people about the financial section is that there was about, I think it was about 13 pages different between the English and the Danish versions of the report, and it was all in the finances. I did translate the Danish document into a, you know, into English, but I should just warn people that obviously it's translated, so there might be some errors. Should also say, not an accountant. So I work in fundraising, so I'm very familiar with budgets and annual reports and, you know, the basics of, you know, what a financial report will look like and things like that. But I am by no means an expert, so I'm sure that there will be some one accountant listening who's like, that's not right. And if it is the case, please do let me know. But I'm also not a total beginner who knows nothing about finances and financial reports.
I was deep in Google at one point, being like, do I need to know this? It's relevant to me in any way.
So the sort of the first section of the financial report kind of lays out some of the legal frameworks that exist to facilitate the make the paying of money to the royal family and how they operate. The first person to talk about really is the monarch. So this is one of the ways where the English and Danish differed. Because if you look at the English version, language version, it says that the money that the monarch gets is from the Civil List Act. But then if you go to the Danish, you see that the full name of the act is the Act on Queen Margrethe II's Civil List. And I'm not just telling you that to be pedantic. The reason why that's important is because the Civil List, which is the essentially the payment that the government makes to the monarchy to carry out their work, is set at the start of each new reign. And so it can be changed for various reasons as time goes on, and it has been changed. But a new one has to be issued at the start of every reign. So for Margrethe, she took the throne in January of 1972, and she got the new law passed about 3.5 months later. So we actually currently don't have a new one for Frederick, but there will be a new one coming in the next probably month or two. So that's just an important thing to say. And that's how it used to work in Britain. It's how it works in lots of monarchies where, like, it isn't a sort of blanket arrangement. Obviously, it was 1972 when she took the throne and when this first act was passed. And in the first act, the allowance that she has was set at 8 million kroner. And if I did look at a specific Danish inflation calculator, and that's like 60 million kroner today. So obviously, when they pass a law in 1972 that says that she gets 8 million kroner, that doesn't mean that she gets 8 million kroner every year forever. Because if she got 8 million kroner now, that would be 10% of what she, less than 10% of what she actually gets. So that would be an abs that would be like £1 million, basically expecting the monarchy to run on £1 million. It would be ridiculous. So they have to incorporate some way of respecting or responding to inflation, really, because that's what changes the value of money as time goes on. And there are different royal families all have to do this. They all have to consider how they account for inflation, but there are different ways that they get around it. And the way that the Danes do it is that they say that the base amount, so sort of that's what's in the law. So it's, you know, 41.9 million kroner in the 2001 law, 8 million in the first law, is adjusted in line with the salary index for government employees. Basically, it kind of means like if the salary of a civil servant who works in the government goes up in line with inflation, then the amount that the monarch gets also goes up in line with the amount that the government employee is going up. I think that's really interesting. Maybe I'm the only one who does. But I think it's really interesting for a few reasons. One is that the British royal families uses a different mechanism, and which we talked about, I think, in episode 69, when we did about 69. The British royal family's finances, but their funding is protected. So the British royal family cannot have a cut in funding from year to year, depending on inflation. It can only go up. There's lots of different ways you can theoretically do it. But I think one of the most unpopular parts of the royal funding is the fact that their salaries, oh, their income, sorry, the money that they get can't decrease. It's ring fenced. And I think that a lot of people, you know, you work in teaching, I work in the charity sector, people might work in the NHS, and when they see their budgets being absolutely destroyed year on year, like cut to the bone, they can barely, you know, you can barely do your job with the money that you get, and then you find out that they're cutting it again and you have to make savings again. Like, it's brutal. And yet a very rich family are legally protected from having a fall in their funding. And I can understand the reasons why the government did that. But I do just, yeah, from a PR perspective, it is quite unpopular to have a very privileged set of people whose money can't decrease while schools and hospitals know that their money could be cut at any moment. And I think having it in line with government employees is really smart, because that's what they are.
Yeah, like royals are paid by the taxpayer, and so are government employees. Therefore, it should always be in sync.
Yeah. The other interesting thing, I mean, mostly just because I wonder how on earth it works, is the allowance is paid monthly. So according to the Act, it's paid monthly in advance. It makes it seem very very much like an allowance.
It's more like pocket money, like, but you know, in terms of millions, like, okay, if you're good and I've got enough money, you can have some. But if we're running out, we have to go without the pocket money this week.
So the next one is the Act on the Annual Annuity to Crown Prince Frederick, which covers Frederick's money. And the first variation of that Act came out in 1986. It was changed in 2004 to account for the fact that he was getting married, and so therefore there would be an increase in, well, there was another person who was going to be doing engagements and going to be doing work. So I think, yeah, it was changed in 2004. And at that point, it was set at 12.8 million kroner. When I saw this, it did drive home to me like how administratively taxing the Danish system is. In the UK, we used to have a system that was like this. So at the start of every reign, they would decide how much money the monarch got, and they would make changes to that as circumstances changed, and they had to look at it regularly because the amount of money might not be correct. And then they changed it so that it changes with how much money the Crown Estate is bringing in. So they don't actually have to make any changes to the amount the monarch is getting, or to the law or anything like that. They did make a change when Buckingham Palace needed renovations and they upped it to 25%. But other than that, you know, like, it doesn't have to change if you get new people coming in or people leaving or anything like that. It just sort of, it can stay the same for as long as it works. Whereas, you know, we know that in Denmark, if you get married, they'll have to do a new law. If you get divorced, they'll have to do a new law. That, you know, the government were specifically trying to avoid a system where they had to think about how much money the monarch gets every new reign, because they wanted to get on with other things.
You know, I as a individual person find money very confusing and hard, and it takes a lot of mind space to do. And I am, you know, functioning with money significantly smaller amounts than, you know, the millions of kroner. So I think the you can kind of see why there are all these sort of, there's almost like there's so many people involved at every step,
mm-hmm.
to make sure that it's to give, you know, to give the right amount to the right people and to percentage it out to the, you know, individually is quite impressive, you know.
The Sovereign Grant Act, which regulates the way that the British royals receive their funding was introduced in 2011. It started in 2012, but it was introduced in 2011. That was a Conservative government. And so I think part of it was also wanting to avoid opening up a difficult conversation every single time the monarch passed away. Because if somebody became a monarch and it happened to be in a time when there was an economic, well, when there's an economic crisis and the monarch isn't necessarily that popular, there's a tendency for, perhaps the government of the day to sort of say, well, we're not going to give you very much. And then that in years to come, that will be inadequate. And it will be because of the mood at the time, which may not reflect the mood in 10 or 20 years. And so then they would have to go back and look at it again. And so I wonder if part of it was just our very British sense of like, we don't want to have this conversation. We'll just set a figure and that'll be fine and we'll leave it like that. And it will sort itself. We'll set it up in a way that it sorts itself out and we don't have to think about it.
Yeah, we just don't want to talk about money at all. So if we can avoid it, we'll do.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think also, I think, I've said this quite a lot, but the approval ratings in Denmark for the monarchy are so insanely high. Obviously, you don't know what could happen. Like, something could happen tomorrow and those approval ratings go through the floor. But they've been so high for 20, 30, 40, 50 years in Margrethe's case. It's far less likely that there would be a real issue where suddenly the public's going, no, don't give them money. And if there was, you can kind of see these mood changes coming, and you can make those. You can be like, okay, so we're hearing more and more people talk about, the royals shouldn't have this money, so we'll change the law now before we get to that stage.
Beyond that, the same conditions apply. So their funding increases in line with the salary index for government employees, and they receive it on a monthly basis, the same way that Margrethe does. But it does also specifically state in the law that Mary gets 10% of that allowance.
Yeah, I saw that and I was like, that seems unfair.
I think it's interesting that she only gets 10% because she does so much. Maybe it's because he has more staff members. So then the last one is the Act on the Annual Annuity for Prince Joachim. That also has changed frequently through the years. So it was increased when he married and then was reduced again when he divorced. Seems like, I mean, I know why, I understand why, but also like, oh, kick you when you're down, isn't it, really?
Yeah, you get a peek as well.
And then it increased again when he remarried. But there isn't anything in the law that states that Marie gets a certain percentage the way that there is with Mary and Frederick. So I wonder if it's just because it's much smaller.
Yeah, I wonder how much of it is also, I'm going to call this sort of like the result of the Alexandra and Joachim breakup. I think the things they did for Alexandra post breakup, they would never do for another royal wife in the same way. And there is no part of me that thinks Joachim and Marie's marriage isn't happy and going to last. I'm sure it is, but he's not to be like he's already had a wife, so maybe there's that kind of like, well, maybe we just don't give Marie her own, and then we'll just sort of cut off any kind of fundings in case something goes wrong again.
Other things to note are that when we go through the figures in more detail, things like state visits, like overseas state visits, when they go somewhere else, security costs and things like that are separate. They're not included in this report, but that is pretty standard for most monarchies. They aren't subject to income tax, which is the same for Charles. Like they don't give you government money and then tax you on it. They do pay kind of estate tax. So that's kind of their private wealth, they will pay tax on that, which is kind of, again, similar to other countries like the UK. But something interesting, they are reimbursed for VAT. If people don't know, because is VAT a global thing?
But isn't that also the thing that in America you have to add on at the till? So I assume it must be a global thing.
It must be a global thing then, but it's just how they present it. But basically, if you don't know what it is, because a lot of people probably don't know what it is, so there is a difference in value between a banana that's not been processed, that's in another country, and a smoothie that's been processed and packaged and branded and is in the shops ready for you to buy. And so basically, the value-added tax sort of looks at, assumes that at each stage of the process of going through developing a product, value is added at each stage. And so you have to add on a tax. And so the royals, if they're buying stamps or cars, no matter what size of thing they're, but cleaning supplies, whatever it is, food for a state banquet, they will be paying VAT in the way that everybody else is. And in Denmark, they get a reimbursement for VAT. So they will buy something in the shops in the same way everyone else does, but then they will go to government and say, this is how much of it was VAT, and the government gives them that back. And I don't believe that that happens in the UK.
No, or if it does, we're not told it
We're not
happens.
told it's happened. So I thought that was very interesting because that's quite a sizable amount of money. That's some sort of general observations about how all of this is funded and that these are the laws that outline how the funding works. But let's go into sort of specifically this year's stats, this year's money. So it starts off with the Queen's, and she gets just over 91 million kroner. And I love European currencies. I used to love going on holiday to Portugal before we had the EU because it was a Scudos. I think I've said the story to you before, but it was a Scudos. And so you would be like, I've got 1,000 Escudos, and you'd feel so rich. But actually, it was only about £10. So 91 million kroner sounds like loads of money. It translates to about £10.4 million or about $13 million.
10. Okay, right, yeah.
Sorry?
I just sort of repeat what you said. I'm like, yeah, okay, I've got that in my head.
10 million for us, 10.4 million. So the overall picture is that there was a deficit this year of 1 million kroner, which is about £115,000 or $145,000. It is so much conversion in this episode.
I'm glad you did, because I'm going to read it all in krona because it sounds so much more dramatic. You're like, yeah, a million deficit. That's huge. Like 115,000 is okay.
So they got 10 million in and £10 million in and had a overspend of £115,000, which is much less than the previous year, which was about eight times higher than that. So they've had a couple of years of deficits. And I think this is giving me an opportunity to talk about one of my pet peeves,
Ooh, I love it.
which is whenever this happens a lot. Again, sorry to bring it back to the British royal family, but every year, the Royal Foundation or Meghan and Harry's charities or whatever will release their sets of accounts. And the people who don't like them will jump on those accounts and be like, look at this. They overspent. They spent more money than they brought in. They are a terrible organization that everybody hates. And I have seen a little bit of sort of panicky coverage in some press. I mean, this hasn't got a lot of coverage, the Danish finances, but the few articles I have seen have been sort of like a they've spent loads of money, it's way too much money, oh my goodness. A deficit doesn't sound great, obviously. It's not sustainable in the long term, in that most organizations, especially one like this, which is not a private company that could just throw money at it at itself, or you know, have a rich dirt person who throws loads of money at it. You know, it can't continue year on year. You can't have a deficit every single year. But people do freak out for the wrong reasons. So, firstly, when they say they've overspent, the money that they the sort of the £100,000 or so that was not something that they'd been given by the government at the start of the year, that came from their savings. So there might be people who would think, oh, well, we have to go. They had to go and ask the government for more money because they're spending loads. And they're like, you know, Oliver Twist sitting there, sort of with their bowl out, being like, please, Danish Prime Minister, can I have some more money? That didn't happen. They just went into their savings. So it didn't actually impact the level of money that the Danish taxpayer provided in any way whatsoever. So that's just the first thing to get out of the way.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yep, exactly. They're not unique in sort of having this situation where they are spending a lot of money and not necessarily having the same level of money coming in. So they're not the only organization or even the only royal family. I know the Swedish royal family have really struggled with their finances in recent years. So they're not the only ones. But I think the big thing to say really is that an annual report is just that. It is an annual report that shows the financial picture for that year. The monarchy didn't get created in 2023. So it's kind of like saying that if you if there was a month where you had your salary that came in and you spent more money than your salary, obviously that's not ideal. You don't want to do that every single month, but that doesn't mean that you're bankrupt because you have all of the money that you've earned in previous months, that hopefully you should be, sort of saving. And you might cut, if you've got a big blowout holiday that's coming up in July, you might cut down on your costs in April, May, and June and put that money aside. And so then the excess, the sort of overspend in July, is covered by the money that you'd already saved in previous years. And so what you can have is a budgeted deficit. So it's like you know that you are going to lose money in this particular year, but you have saved for it in previous years so that you have loads of money in your savings. It's like a rainy day fund, essentially. It's actually not the end of the world because if you look back in their accounts in 2021, they had a surplus of 1.7 million kroner. In 2020, it was 2 million kroner, and so on. So, like, they knew that there was going to be Margrethe's Jubilee and other things that might cost more money. And so they saved money while they could and budgeted that they would have a deficit in this year. So, like, I just want, I don't, is that making sense?
Yeah, and it makes sense because I didn't realize that. In my head, I was like, oh. And I remember, I've read it with other royal families as well. Like, I know they have savings, but when you read deficit, I'm like, well, that means they've spent all their savings and they've only got, and they're in debt and no one seems to care. Clearly not. I liked your thing about the holiday because that made the most sense to me. Like, oftentimes your holiday is going to be more than the amount of money you get in that term. That term that with that month, but you have the savings to bulk your money out, which is I think because we talk about royals in terms of taxpayer funding, we tend not to think about like saving money, like their own reserves, in the same way that like if you were talking to a normal non-taxpayer funded human, you were going, oh yeah, well, how much money have you got in the bank?
Yeah, exactly. And with monarchies, they can forecast for things that are coming. So they know that Margrethe was going to have a jubilee because that's the year that it would happen. So they know that there's going to be more expenditure in that year. So basically, chill out is what I would say.
Yes, a good rule for any discussion about monarchies ever. Chill
Yeah,
out.
just chill out. Yeah. And in the UK, there's a limit on what they're allowed to put in reserves because the idea is that if they're putting over half the money in reserves every single year with no idea about what they're going to do with it, then probably they don't need as much money as they're getting. So the idea is that they should be spending what they get to do the work that they're supposed to do. But if they have, they know that they're going to be doing a jubilee or whatever, they can put some of that money aside, and so they have it there to be able to draw on. So it's and also I think it's significant that they decreased the overspend by, eight times. So like clearly they are not hoping to sustain that level of like having £1 million overspend every single year. Like they've already cut it down by eight times. They have already said in the report that they're conscious of making decisions so that they can continue to keep that low and cut it down and sort of get back onto a position where they're not having this deficit over and over again. So it's they are managing it responsibly. It's not something to be worried about, basically.
That's a good thing. And I think, this year I would therefore probably expect there to be a bigger deficit again because there was kind of a surprise
Surprise
monarch,
abdication, yeah.
surprise new monarch thing, which apparently they couldn't plan for because Margrethe just kept that one to herself. But in the long term, they've had the 50th birthdays of Fred and Mary, and they've had Christian's 18th, and there won't be another jubilee. So theoretically, they've done all the big celebrations for like the next 5 years.
So the next section was the income statement, which is kind of more specifically about sort of how they actually spent the money that they did spend. And very unsurprisingly, I would say the biggest cost was staffing, which accorded to about 60% of their total expenditure. And I think if you looked at any set of royal accounts, it would probably be the same.
I know. I read that, and my first thought was like, not to say to pay your staff less, but come on, guys. I'm like, hang on, so what am I saying? Like, no, pay your staff more.
Well, we're very, I didn't know we were sort of starting class warfare in this podcast. I mean, I should have because we're a royal podcast, but I thought like we were on the side of the working people, Grace.
Honestly, I changed my once I thought that thought, I was like, no, what am I doing? My first thought was, oh, clearly that's how the expenditure is. Cut some salaries, it'll be fine.
But
No.
you're brutal. Oh, you should be one of those management consultants who just goes into companies and tells them to sack half their staff and then leaves again.
I think I'd be really good at that because, like, I don't have any emotional attachment to them. So I'm like, yeah,
Yeah.
off you go.
I mean, neither do I, but I have this pretense about myself that I'm some sort of liberal fight for the people kind of thing. But then I also have my iPhone and.
Right, because if I was a philanthropist, like a rich one, and I'd had could support myself, I could afford to be, you know, kind and.
It's much easier to be kind if you're rich, yeah.
But until that point, it's
Yeah.
kind of a me above everyone else situation.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think but I think it does seem huge, but then you've got to think about, like, it's not just when people think about, like, royal staff, they're thinking about maybe William and Kate's team of sort of, you know, they've got their private secretaries and they've got some comms people and, you know, a couple of other people who float about, like one housekeeper, one nanny.
And they tend to boast a lot when they're like, yeah, William Kay only have like five members of staff. But first of all, that's not even true because the person who drives their car to engagements is a member of staff, but they're not in the like special staffing lists. I think, you know, like the institution of monarchy is huge, and I think it is everything from your, you know, your private secretaries and your bodyguards to your you know, etiquette masters and, you know, elocution and speech writers and pronunciation experts,
The
like even
monarch's
your
official harpist.
bagpipe players, you know, all the classics. But like if, you know, Mary and Fred were off on a trip to Tonga and they wanted to do a bit in, you know, I don't know what language to speak in Tonga, like Tonganese maybe, but
Yeah, you maybe
you
should have picked a country where you knew the language they speak.
Spain, they were going to Spain in Spanish. They might need to get an official Spanish speaker to check their pronunciation. And even, you know, that might not be a permanently employed person, but they would pay them for the work they do for the monarchy. And that would all fit under this sort of umbrella of 60% of the outgoings.
Yeah, so that's the biggest expenditure is for staffing. I didn't go through every single category of expenditure because, as I say, 60% of it is the staff, so that's quite a significant amount. But the next highest category, which I think is an interesting one that we have to talk about, is in English, it's called the expenditure cap, but in the Danish version, it's called the frame amount, and that's what the Danish press use when they talk about it. So I'm going to call it the frame amount. And this is something that does happen in other royal families, not the British, quite notably, but in other royal families. And we have talked, I think the abdication episode, we talked about some of this. But basically, the government gives them all this money, and the vast majority of it is used to pay for their staff and, you know, as all the things, categories I said earlier. But then a set amount of it goes to them, kind of like a salary, and they use that for clothing, furniture of their own house, you know, their private expenditure. So they obviously have their own separate private wealth that's from inheritances and things like that. But then this is basically like a government paid salary. So in the UK, it's different because the money that we get from the government goes towards official expenditure only. And then the senior royals, so the monarch and the heir, have their duchies, the Duchy of Cornwall and the Duchy of Lancaster, which provide money for them to be able to use privately. And so that's how we do it in the UK, and it means that they get a huge amount of money. But in other countries, it's like a segment of their official payment. It's actually the second highest figure was for Margrethe's frame amount, which was 13 million kroner, or just under 1.5 million pounds, or $2 million.
I mean, I spend my entire time and look at these things being like, what do rich people spend their money on? Because, I mean, once I've bought the house and got and you know some high quality clothes which last me a long time, you know, after a point you've run out of things to buy, and Margrethe's been queen for a long time.
This is what I found interesting because they said they gave examples, but they only gave, as far as I remember, clothing and furniture. I was like, there's more, there surely there's more things that they get than clothing and furniture. Like, does this pay for her food that she eats?
The shreddies.
Does it pay for her shreddies? I don't even know if other countries have shreddies. They're just a brand
I
of
actually
cereal.
googled it during this and I
Did
found
you?
out that sadly shreddies is banned in Denmark and you have to import it from the UK. So
Banned? Why?
very traumatic. I don't know, something to do with it being like artificial.
Oh my goodness, you're missing. That's my favorite cereal.
It's a great cereal.
My favorite one, so you're missing out. Anyway, sorry. Yes, so it doesn't explain. It just says clothing and furniture, which I like the idea that rich people are just like, what do people spend money on? Clothing and furniture. Like, how much furniture do you need?
They're like, yeah, my greatest, another 14 sofas,
Yeah,
guys.
exactly. Like, I know they've got big houses and things, but a lot of it will be antiques and stuff that they've had in the family for a long time. Do they really need to buy that many desks? I don't know. So yeah, that's interesting that, and I think it makes it difficult because, I've seen a lot of articles in recent years where there are like the Guardian did a whole feature where they compared the amount of money that the Brits cost versus other monarchies, and the gist of it was the British are so much more expensive and everything is terrible. And I think that that was naive on lots of different levels because they didn't think like, oh, but Denmark's really small. There was no mention of the fact that like Denmark is tiny compared to the UK. So that was one thing. But also you can't compare because the money that is going to Margrethe also has this set amount that is going towards her privately, whereas in the UK that doesn't happen. So it's like, do in the UK do you want to consider, and this is the debate that nobody settled really, but do you want to consider the duchies as being part of the cost of the monarchy, or is that separate? And if in Margrethe's case, should we discount that? But it is coming from the government directly, so maybe we shouldn't. And so you can't really compare the two countries in terms of the amount of money they get.
It makes to me a lot of sense for the government to be like, and here's your living costs. But then I think the difficulty for me would be like trying to, without there being, unless there is a rule book written somewhere that they give to you when you become a royal, like on your fifth birthday, like, and these are the things that are private and these are the things that are public. I would be like, okay, but theoretically, if I am, buying shoes that I'm only going to wear for my job, and I'm only going to these galas because I'm being, it's my patronage has asked me to. It's not even something I've offered to do. I'm like, well, technically, that's not me doing it. My petrol money to go, if I'm driving to an engagement and then driving home, I don't know how to split the petrol in my head. I don't know how petrol works, in all honesty, but I wouldn't know how to tell the difference between what petrol I had spent driving to an engagement and what petrol I had spent driving to pick up the kids from school. So I would find that really, really confusing if I was trying to split it. All from the same kind of pot of money. Whereas if you have two pots, then you can be like, right, this is coming from pot one, so it has to be official stuff. Whereas this is pot two, so it's not.
Yeah, we don't actually know how any of this works. We know it hits their bank account, but we don't know if like, yeah, does Margrethe have a credit card that she can use to go and buy furniture with her private money, or does she have to have it signed off by somebody specific? We don't, and that's even though there are monarchies with, I would say Denmark's probably more transparent than the UK. I think there are still like areas where I was reading this and I was like, I would be interested to know that, and I'd be interested to know this, and I don't, so there's still things that you don't know.
I like to imagine that they end up having to like ask like the financial advisor is just in charge of their money, so they want to go buy some spreadsheets and like, okay, no, you're asking him this time. We need to get more cereal. I was like, no, I asked him last time.
Yeah. Then the next section was the balance sheet, which I'm going to kind of keep quite brief, but I just wanted to highlight it because I think a lot of people, when they read financial accounts, look at the income and expenditure. Because even if you don't know much about money, you can kind of understand what that means. And the balance sheet is actually really important for understanding the broader financial picture because the accounts, as I mentioned earlier, like the accounts show you a snapshot of the year of how much money you've had coming in and how much money you're going out. But the balance sheet will show you things like how much cash you have in the bank. It has your fixed assets. So they if you're a company that is like an admin or a recruitment company, you might own the building that you work from, and that is a physical, a fixed asset, because it means that like if your company went down the toilet, you could sell that building, the value of your investment. So you might invest some of your money and get some stuff back. You have the sort of the cash in the bank. And then the balance sheet also shows you the debts that you have to pay. So again, you can't just look at this financial year because what if they've committed to paying a huge amount of money in the next financial year? And so that kind of gives you a better picture of sort of how much money you have at your disposal at the moment. Even though they overspent money, it might be confusing to people who don't know much about accounts, but like, even though they overspent last year, they still have money in the bank.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And then so we move on to the Crown Princess couple. No, we don't. The Crown Princely couple. Now they're king and queen, but they were the Crown Princely couple at the time. And so I've not gone into quite as much detail because I think a lot of the points, about like what a deficit actually means, I've already covered. But the overall picture for them is that they received 22.4 million kroner, which is 2.6 million pounds or $3.2 million, roughly. And they had quite a similar financial picture. So they overspent actually by about the same amount, even though they receive about a quarter of the amount that Margrethe gets. They overspent by about the same amount. So their finances are not doing quite as well. But again, if you go back and look at, 2021, 2020 accounts, they also had a surplus in those years. Their biggest expenditure was also staffing. And then they have their own framework amount, so the amount that they can use for their own sort of private expenditure, which is 4.5 million kroner, which is about £500,000 or $650,000.
That seems significantly smaller, considering there's two of them, and four children to support, whereas Margrethe's just Margrethe.
They don't actually get in very much at all. Whereas, Kate has millions at her disposal. She could be wearing couture at every engagement if she wanted to. It wouldn't be a good idea PR wise, but she could afford it.
Yeah, she'd be like, "Yeah, this is not costing you lot me stuff. This is for my husband's account."
As much as royals are rich, like what Mary is richer than I will ever be. But I also think, like, they get a salary of £500,000 a year, which is less than like a CEO of a lot of places.
Yeah, it's like we talk in. I mean, I work in a school, and we tell a lot of sort of jokes about how executive head teachers get like six figure salaries, and like for doing nothing. But I'm thinking of the executive head teacher of the current trust I'm in, and they will be making more in a year than the Crown Prince family of Denmark is making in a year independently, which is quite funny to think about, really.
Yeah, so, and you've got to share your money with your spouse.
Yeah, honestly, at
Yeah.
least I can't see why would you be a royal? Just marry a rich non-royal person.
Exactly. Oh, I was talking about this with my mum the other day because I was saying, like, and I said, really, Pippa had the right idea because she married a billionaire and nobody cares what she does. So nobody has
Yeah,
any
she's
right to
like,
care what she
I
does.
know. I do think sometimes that until William became the Duke of Cornwall, Pippa was much richer than Kate was.
Anyway, but yeah, and then the other thing I've seen, so I've seen a lot of articles that have been about how Crown Princess Mary overspent by 1 million kroner. And I understand that Mary is the most famous one of the family, like overseas, and this was a sort of English language press. But that's unfair.
Yes, it's not just her.
He gets 90% of the money. But the difficulty is like they put the income and the expenditure. So the income is just the total amount that they get. And then the expenditure is what they spent on each category. But we don't have the original budget. So we don't know how much they earmarked for staffing costs, how much was supposed to go towards costs of administration, how much was specifically for postage. They probably have some idea of that, but we don't. So we can't say, we know that they overspent by 1 million, but we can't say where any of the overspend actually came from because we don't have the original budget. So there is absolutely no way that anybody can say that it was Mary's fault specifically that they overspent.
Mary, how could you?
Yeah. It's all that furniture.
So, all those sofas they keep buying. So Mary's obsessed with sofas.
If only they came from the country with IKEA.
Yeah, that would really help them out, sadly. Just getting Lego furniture is where it's going wrong for them.
Ooh, Lego. Furniture. No, I don't think that would fit in with the classy palace vibe, would it really, if all of their furniture was made of Lego?
Feel like it'd be really uncomfortable.
And then the last but not least, they do break down, well, they do give you how much money Joachim gets, but they do not break it down. It just says, it's like literally a whole page that's for Joachim's, but it just says he gets this much money and that's it. It's a tiny little thing at the top of the page. It's so funny when all these other pages are full of information. This is just like one line. They didn't need an entire separate page for that. It feels passive aggressive.
Here you go, Joachim. We'll mention you. We'll give you a whole page to yourself. And it's like a sentence.
Can 100% that imagine that happening. But basically, he receives just under 4 million kroner, so about £300,000 or $375,000. You hear a lot of criticism of the work rate of Joachim and Marie and the fact that they don't do enough and they don't live in Denmark anymore. And it's like, but they aren't getting any more money. So how are they supposed to dramatically increase, even if they wanted to, which I think they probably would, based on what they've said. They don't have the money to be able to do 10 times more engagements than they currently do. So how do people expect them to do that?
That's always the thing that gets me. I think whenever anyone talks about any royal family and they talk about like we need them to do more work and
Like
I'm
we
like,
do.
okay, yeah, we do it all the time. But I'm like, at its sort of core, where you have to then give them the more money to do that. And nobody wants to give any royals more money. It's a double-edged sword.
Yeah, and I think it's fair that we do it about the British royal family because we know that they can do 4,000 engagements with the money that they got.
Yeah.
They're not doing four. They could do that. It's possible. It's feasible. It's happened before lots of times, and they're not doing that. Thank you, everybody, for joining us for this episode this week. It was nice to talk about something that wasn't related to health. If you have any suggestions for future episodes, please do send them to us on Tumblr or our email or Instagram. All of our links are in the description. Rate us 5 stars on all good podcast providers. But other than that, it is a goodbye from me.
And goodbye from me.